I'm not a hero. Definitely not a hero. The only heroes in any war are the ones that don't come back.
Calm waters.
And shortly I saw the outline of France, and that was the first time the adventure ceased to be an adventure.
I could hear it all. Gunfire, machine guns, screaming, men shouting. This is a war.
June the 6th, 1944. It was the biggest beach assault in history, a day of bloody battle in the air, at sea, and on land.
The place was alight. Boats all in the sea, hundreds and hundreds of them, heavy gunfire.
A day ordinary people were called upon to do extraordinary things. A day that left its mark on all of those who took part in it.
You personally feel there's nothing going to happen to you. That's the feeling I went in with, but I was wrong.
It was called Operation Overlord and became better known as D-Day. These beaches saw a turning point in the Second World War, and the sacrifice was huge.
Inscribed columns in a colonnade.
In his belt, he had a miniature revolver. And I thought, this is what he does, you know? This is how we get killed.
This actually shows the ship you were on just...
80 years on, the BBC has been gathering first-hand accounts from the surviving UK veterans, now in their 90s or more than 100 years of age.
In the distance, German fighters, the best of them, fastest of them.
It had to happen. We had to conquer Europe again, otherwise we wouldn't win the war.
These are their voices. Their stories preserved for future generations. Their memories of what happened here in Normandy on D-Day and beyond.
Waves washing over images of young servicemen storming a beach and old soldiers wearing their medals. Written in sand, the date 6th of June, 1944. D-Day 80. We were there. Black and white footage of men in civvies signing up.
Britain had been at war with Germany since 1939. By the end of that year, more than 1.5 million people had joined the armed forces.
We were all young lads, like same age as me, and living in a small market town like Buckingham, we joined the territorials. For something to do, actually. We never realised what was going to happen.
We went to the Navy because I had been in a fishing boat and they'd been looking after the engine. I was placed in the engine room, of course.
I said, oh yes, I'd like to be a motorcycle dispatch rider. And they said, oh, sorry, he said, no vacancies. So I thought, oh, never mind. He said, oh, by the way, he said, they do have dispatch riders in the Royal Army Service Corps. I said, OK, thank you very much, OK.
In Bomber Command, the kill rate was almost 50%. When I signed on, I didn't realise I was almost signing my life away.
So went into the next room and talked to a flight sergeant. I must give you an intelligence test before I accept you. Can you spell bicycle? So I spelled bicycle. Good, that's right. Can you add a quarter and a half and a third? And I did that. Oh, you'd make a very good armourer. I said, what is an armourer? And he said, do you deal with bombs and guns?
All who have laboured long hours at bench and desk, at drawing board and furnace, look now and ask, have I done well?
Christian Lamb.
The whole plan was D-Day, and this was going to be the most amazing, extraordinary, enormous invasion had ever been in history.
I probably had about 18 months of training of one sort or another, really, for this, for D-Day and going, you know, the biggest... the biggest kind of sea-to-land invasion that there's ever been in the world, I think.
Now, Portsmouth in March, April 1944 was a hive of activity. But the thing is, Fort Southwick, which was our working place, was a very secret communication centre dug deep into tunnels in the cliffs. Each tunnel contained a branch of communications.
We were working with the Americans that were in Slaps and Sands in South Devon. We'd go up every now and then and have a rehearsal. We'd have anything from kind of 10 to 20 American landing craft with 30 men in each craft. And then we'd all go in and practice landing on South Devon.
German warships.
Well, we needed to know what the German fleet were planning and, if possible, stop them doing it. They kept radio silence most of the time, but we were searching up and down their radio frequencies in our little secret stations.
We knew it was coming, but of course we didn't know where or when or what the details of it were. But the fact that there's going to be a second front was known as something that it had to happen.
In Whitehall, Christian Lamb knew more than most. She had been entrusted with highly sensitive information.
I was put into a little office down in this basement. I had an office just to me, entirely alone. And there was an admiral who was giving me orders, and he ordered me to make some maps. The whole of my office was covered, all the walls, with enormous maps of big-scale France. And we were absolutely frozen to secrecy, you can imagine. The whole place was rather humming with activity. Churchill used to visit quite often, and we used to see him on stairs occasionally, keep out of the way, but it was a very exciting moment when you did see Churchill.
In the weeks before D-Day, the Prime Minister was also seen on the south coast.
We had this listening station in a rather remote place in the cliffs outside Dover, and I went out about 8 o'clock one morning, and to my astonishment, there was a little group of officers, and quite recognisably, Winston Churchill and General Eisenhower. You were supposed to salute people of that rank, but as I'd been on duty all night and was just informally dressed, all I could do was wave and say good morning, and so they all waved back and said good morning. Churchill wanted it to be reported back that he and Eisenhower had been down on the Kent coast to deceive the Germans into thinking the landings were going to be into the Calais area. So this was just one of the ploys to prepare for the Normandy landings.
A plotting table.
We had chosen 5 different places, and each of them were a landing position. Each had a code word.
A simple map showing the 5 landing beaches on a stretch of Normandy coast. Sword, Juno, Gold, Omaha and Utah.
Detailed plans to invade France had been made since December 1943. Britain had been sent around 9 million tonnes of supplies and equipment. And by the summer of 1944, more than 2 million troops from 12 countries were stationed here. The Allies were ready to invade.
Eddie Brown.
And all of a sudden they said, they're leaving. So, what do you mean, leaving? So I said to Sergeant Brown from Nottingham, I said, what about my girl? He said, Eddie, I haven't seen you. I haven't spoke to you. Get on your bloody bike and go and say you're leaving her. I said, leaving her? Yeah. I got on my bike and went and see her. And I had to call out the shop, because you couldn't do anything in them days, unless you spoke to the manager. And she came out, I said, "Wynne, I'm leaving." I said, "I don't know where we're going, I've not been told." She said, "Well, do you mean I'm not going to see you again?" I said, "I'll be back. I'll be back to see you, darling. I meant that."
We had to assemble or muster at a place called Weybridge, and that's where we learned to waterproof the guns, the vehicles, and we knew we were going overseas somewhere.
We were moved from Portsmouth to Felixstowe on the East Coast. That was a long journey. Of course, there again, you get the clever boys on the unit, "Oh, we're going there because we're going to invade Norway." And then we boarded this landing ship tank, which was a big vessel, carried 200 troops and could take 4 or 5 tanks and our vehicles as well. And then we set off sailing. Instead of turning left for Norway, we turned right for France.
We went down country lanes, a long, long convoy, and people were either silent or waving or cheering or calling out, "God bless you," or something like that. And that became moving. And they held up the newspapers so we could see what was happening.
Well, you knew down you were going to invade, because all the lanes and roads, they had soldiers in, tanks everywhere. How Jerry didn't know it was going to come from where it did come, it is baffling that we were loaded and waiting.
We were actually in sealed camps before we went in there. The whole of south of England was just one great sealed camp, all awaiting to be taken across to Normandy.
I always remember it was Sunday morning, people going to church. And we had a good idea what was happening. We thought, say a prayer for us. We'd been briefed in the meantime that it was, you know, this was the real thing.
The Allies needed clear skies, calm seas and a low tide. So D-Day was set for Monday, the 5th of June. But as the weather worsened, General Eisenhower decided there had to be a delay.
Before we left Portsmouth, everybody got rather bored. The sailors couldn't go ashore. Officers, of course, in a wardroom can drink, but sailors, apart from their daily rum, don't get anything to drink. And they were all getting very bored and almost a bit mutinous.
This sort of gloom sits over everybody, and they're all sort of talking quietly, and somebody starts singing and anything to pass the time away. Even on the truck going down to the docks in Tilbury to get on, the lads are all singing on the way down. Something to do.
It was just an adventure, I think. We couldn't land the other side because the weather was too rough, the water was too rough. So we laid off ride for 3 days. We were fed well because we were on a brand new ship. My brother and I used to say goodbye to England each night and then wake up in the morning and England was still there.
Then Eisenhower received fresh information from meteorologists, a temporary break in the weather. The American general ordered the invasion to begin on the 6th of June.
Eisenhower gave the word, "Go," and we went. It's the most amazing sight, all these boats heading for Normandy, you know.
It was the morning of the day before D-Day that the captain opened the envelope and saw what our job was. And then it was only about 5 or 6 hours later that we moved off.
The night before D-Day, I was the youngest RAF sergeant on the unit, and I had to man a Bren gun on the deck of this landing ship tank for 2 hours for any low-flying aircraft. Luckily, none came, and I tell the truth, I was frightened to death.
And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we were all awake and don't know where we were going. Sergeant Brown came around and gave us a one franc note.
What's this? We must be going to bloody France.
Eddie Brown was right. Along with 132,000 other troops, he was heading to France. But before they got there, the RAF would attack Normandy from the skies.
Nobody tell us it was Invasion Day when we went out. We didn't know. It was just another operation. Our target was the place where the Americans were landing. And in that area, there were German gun emplacements, and our job was to bomb that bit. And we did that at a few minutes past five in the morning to help the chaps on the ground. And as we turned away, we just happened to notice in the distance four little planes, German fighters, Focke-Wulfs. The best of them, fastest of them. And we spotted them, and then we had red things flying past the aircraft, you know. They were obviously firing at us. And my rear gunner, Wally, who died just a little while ago, was shouting, "Get into the cloud! Get into the cloud!" Because there was a sort of cloud base. It wasn't very thick. But we had been told to stay above, and he was shouting, "Get into the cloud!" And my word, we got into the cloud.
An animated map.
At around the same time as Gilbert's Lancaster had taken off on its bombing raid, 180 men had already arrived at the eastern edge of the invasion site.
Presenter Rachel Burden is on a bridge spanning a canal.
They landed by air, by glider, in the dead of night behind enemy lines. Their job was to secure or destroy vital German positions, including here at Pegasus Bridge, which saw the opening battle of D-Day.
Jack Mortimer.
These paratroopers landed very early on D-Day. They possibly saved hundreds and hundreds of lives on Sword Beach. Maybe I wouldn't be here. Whenever I've been back to that cemetery, three or four times, and I often have to sit down and have a little weep.
I'd been woken up early on D-Day and told that we had at last made our landing, which we'd been expecting for quite a long time. And it was rather tense until we knew what was happening the other side, because we didn't hear for some time whether we were being successful or not.
In the English Channel, 7,000 vessels were heading to the French coast.
This actually shows the ship you were on just a few hours into D-Day.
John Roberts was 20, a junior officer on board the destroyer HMS Serapis.
We were going with the leading minesweepers. We had to sweep a channel for all the ships to go up.
When we did sail, you couldn't see the water for ships. And you thought, bloody hell, nothing's going to happen to us.
It was a cloudy night, but full moon. So it was light, but not moonlight. And over to the left, or port side, we could see Le Havre. And over to the right, it was Cherbourg. And both were being attacked by the RAF and the American Air Force. So there was terrific excitement there on either side of us. But where we were, you could almost just hear the water lapping against the ship's side. And about every 10 minutes, there'd be a splash as the minesweepers would drop a buoy into the water to mark the channel for the ships coming afterwards. And then as we got closer to the coast, we realised that things were going to liven up.
And this is the actual offshore scene at the opening of the battle for the beaches.
So when you got a sense of what was about to happen, does the energy change there on the destroyer?
Oh, it certainly did. I think everybody had rather mixed feelings. We were pleased to be actually going off to do it. But on the other hand, we were also conscious of the fact that it might not be easy. When we got to about 8 miles, I think, There was a loud explosion, and the destroyer next to us was torpedoed, and it sank within 2 or 3 minutes. About half the crew, who were Norwegian sailors, died. And that sort of brought it home to us that this wasn't a picnic.
Points of resistance inland are hammered by salvos from Allied warships.
Just before 5:30 in the morning, the huge naval bombardment of German positions along the French coastline began. It would last for 2 hours.
I must have been frightened, I think. It was frightening, it was. Because the noise was terrific. There was the American battleships were actually giving us cover and fire. They were firing shells over our heads. And the Germans, of course, they were firing from the shore. You used to watch the flash and you wonder where the shell was going to land, you know.
Everybody was bombarding. It was a fantastic noise. And then bombers came over and they didn't fly across the beach. They flew along the beach, dropping bombs all the way along. So as we looked at the beach, you could see it flickering with flame. There were some rocket launchers, and they would all launch together, 25, disappear into the cloud, and then come down in a shower on the beach, and the beach virtually exploded. It was the most amazing sight, which I've never seen anything like it since.
They said, oh, you'll be OK, or you'll be walking ashore. But the Germans were all dug in. I mean, they had 4 years to dig these massive big gun emplacements and concrete. And of course, they were, through all our shelling and bombing, they'd hardly touch them.
Tidal pools on a wide stretch of beach.
At 7:25, the first British soldier came ashore here at Gold Beach. Along the coastline, tens of thousands of Allied troops waded through the chilly waters.
Archive footage of warships sailing in convoy. George Horner.
D-Day. That's actually 1944. I remember it well. We crossed the channel. And that's rough going. Irish route, Allied killer short beach.
Right at the very last moment, the American said, well, gee, because Utah Beach is going to be an American beach, we, in the nicest way, we don't want the Brits leading us on there. And he said, hell's bells, well, what are we going to do? And they said, well, we've got something else for you to do.
We got into line towards the beach, then turned to port, so we were parallel with the beach. And when they dropped the flags, it was time for us to turn on the beach and just sun in and land as best we could.
And they said, well, sorry, we have to tell you, the lead ship was blown out of the water in the first half an hour. And we thought, good God, if they hadn't altered the orders, etc., and want to have their own ship there, we would have been there, we could be blown out of the water. We might have been seriously injured, we could even be dead, of course.
The place was alight. Boats all in the sea, hundreds and hundreds of them. Not many aeroplanes were, but there's heavy gunfire from land to beach.
And as we approached, you can imagine the noise going on, bang, 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 and God knows what terrible noises. And we had to climb down a sort of rope ladder. You let yourself down onto the landing craft where your vehicle is. You then take your seat and you start the engine up. The crew get in behind you. They sit in their seats where they manoeuvre the gun, and off you go for the beach.
The initial forces were in our area in Juneau. Were Canadian. They had a disastrous time with a lot of casualties, and we sort of went through pushing away their boats and obstacles to get to the actual beach itself. And there was only about 20 yards worth of sand left when we got there.
The infantry mix offloaded onto barges
and a lot were only young, and they were crying for their mother during that journey, and sick as dogs. And they were in a real mess, and you can imagine what it was like for them.
Just a mess of soldiers running everywhere, really. Some carried guns, some would be with other units, you know, and calling for their mates. Sometimes you see some of them go down, and you just have to ignore it. It's part of the war.
A few of the longshore were sunk, a heavy fire coming, you know. We had to wait about 100 yards, 150 yards, and on the beach, you know. I remember saying to myself, Horner, you get in here with two legs, two arms, I say maybe I have to come out. So I made that point, get in behind somebody bigger than me. I got behind it.
Don Jones.
I was in charge of all the guns on the landing craft. I was on the port gun. A shell came over from the German battery. It went through the door of the wheelhouse, where my number two was crouching down, about 2 feet over his head, out through the starboard side, hit the guardrail, and didn't explode. I looked at Jack's face, and the look on his face, because he was deafened in. And I started laughing. It might have been a bit hysterical, really, I suppose.
2 months before D-Day, I was given training on a small radio set with levers. I would pass whatever messages I had to, and then they would lift their lever and pass their responses. And it was when they lifted their lever that I realised I was listening to warfare, because they were landing on the beaches.
You're scared to death. You didn't know whether you was going to come out of it or not. You didn't think about dying or nothing like that. You just thought, what's going to happen? And you prayed to God that you'd come home.
They jumped out of the landing craft, different type of landing craft to ours, where the front door came down. They dropped in the water. It was so deep, all the equipment they were carrying weighed them down, and they were drowned.
And some of them never saw the full light of day. They either died in the barges when the barge hit the mine, or they died on the beach. It was shocking.
I could hear it. I could hear it all. Gunfire, machine guns, cannon, screaming, men shouting, orders being shouted, all manner of things. And you suddenly thought, this is a war. I really had the war in my ears.
And when we landed, it was sad to see all of the dead soldiers lying on the beach. The first time I'd ever seen a dead person.
Scared to death. You know, we had a job to do and we had to get on with it. And they, you know, couldn't do it. You couldn't show you were scared because you'd be letting your mates down. But, you know, anyone who say they weren't scared, they're idiots.
The men who you should take the hat off to are the men who come up those beaches from those landing craft. It was just almost certain death for lots of them. And I reckon they were really brave men, really brave. We were lucky with our landing, very lucky.
Bill Gladden's lucky landing came hours after the first wave of D-Day forces had reached France. He was part of the 6th Airborne Armoured Reconnaissance Regiment.
On their way over, which was in the afternoon of D-Day, it was a bit buoyed inside of the glider and a tank as near as that in front of me. I thought myself, there's three little portholes inside. I'll climb up and I'll have a look out, see what's going on. So I clambered up on the top and I saw tugs and gliders going across, but I couldn't see down. And suddenly, as if you hit a brick wall, well, we knew what that was, that's when the tow rope goes. Well, there's a rule in, whenever you're in a glider and they drop the tow rope, you keep still, because that gives the glider pilot a weight problem for moving his aircraft about. So all I could do was freeze, spread-eagled on the top of the tank, and that's how I made my rather unorthodox landing in Normandy.
On the beaches where most of the British forces had landed, the Allies were holding their positions.
It was so noisy in our own department, the tanks revving up, the rattling of chains on the door. We'd taken those people within 10 feet of where we were destined to be. We were there dead on time, although we were delayed by the sea. We'd done our job. Yeah, we were pleased.
There were thousands and thousands of men around, of soldiers around, loads and loads of vehicles, tanks and artillery, all being dropped off at each point, and everybody knew exactly where they were, which part of the beach they were supposed to be at. For my part and for 6th Beach Group, it was absolutely efficient. Everybody was hitting off all right.
But there were some exceptions.
We landed on the wrong beach. We landed on the Canadian beach, which was next door to where we should have landed. Went up the road and this MP's, "What unit are you? You're not on my list. Get out of the way, you're stopping the trouble." We went down this tiny road, found a field with an empty house at the bottom of it, and stayed there overnight.
We were very fortunate, although there was snipers in some of the buildings that were still standing back from the beach, and there was also German artillery further back. But before we arrived, the engineers had gone in. They moved the mines to make a safe passageway for us to come off.
Well, we had a bit of small arms fire come up, but nothing big, just small arms. It was mainly snipers. They were up in the gantry of the church, and they were up trees, and even if they were shot, they never fell down because they always strapped up there. But in fact, there were some paras, they were holed up in the hedgerows, they couldn't move. As soon as they moved, the snipers were picking them off right, left and centre.
By the evening of D-Day, the Allies were moving inland, fighting beyond the beaches.
Through the villages towards Caen, Isigny and Carentan, and Montbourg and St. Mary.
The invasion force had prevailed, but thousands of men were dead.
One of the fellows says, "Where's our four mates?" Of course, we hadn't seen them. I said, "I don't know." Taffy said, "There's a rifle in the ground there, pointing down, with a helmet on the top. Now, that's a sign of casualties." It was no more than 50 yards from where we were. And my four mates was dead in that field. They'd struck by a mortar bomb. And all along there was dead bodies where we were that night. That all along there covered over with. And life changed a bit for us then.
In the days that followed, as the warships continued to shell German positions miles inland, many more British forces arrived at the beaches.
and shortly I saw the outline of France, and that was the first time I really began to, you know, realise what I was going into. The adventure ceased to be an adventure, and I became frightened. I had a prayer book with me, a psalm, book of psalms, which I did make use of, I must admit. As it got lighter, you could see all the ships around us, as close as these two chairs are. It was packed, it was like being on a pond, but nobody was bothering to fire at me, so I didn't complain.
Aboard HMS Serapis, John Roberts found time to write to his mother.
We are settling down to our new life quite happily here. It is all fairly hard work, but still good fun. We have had excitements with German destroyers, E-boats, shore batteries and aircraft, and have scored quite well against them all, especially the destroyers. We can almost see Germans all the time, and we run around within 6 or 7 miles of them all day. They are not particularly aggressive, though, because they get blown sky high if we see them or their gun flashes.
We used to have a bit to eat if we got time, get in our lorries, go down to the beaches and get more stuff for tomorrow. Petrol and water and food and everything else, ammunition and bombs and God knows what else. And we did that every night, and so we didn't get much sleep. There is, won't be still there, but there's a pair of socks there that I took off after a fortnight, stuffed in a hedge somewhere.
I was amazed by the fact that we went from the beach up to a crossroads, and on point duty there was a military policeman with his white belt, white gaiters, just as if he was in Piccadilly Circus or anywhere else. And he was controlling the traffic, boards, directing. It was fantastically organised, fantastic.
We're given French money, occupation money, that is. We're given a booklet asking questions. We could ask where the nearest railway station was, where this was, where the Germans were. But when they answered in French, we couldn't understand the answers. We were taught about something called venereal diseases, which I'd never heard of until then.
We looked after every aircraft you would think possible. We didn't have competitions exactly, but we reckoned we could, a squadron of Spitfires or something that would land and needed petrol and ammunition, we could all do it in about 20 minutes and they'd be ready for takeoff again.
The sun came up and it got warmer, so we took off our shirts and we then took off our trousers, and then we were just finishing up laying there just in our pants, sunbathing. Beautiful. If this is war, bring it on, you know.
I always remember a lot of these French refugees walking past, families, horse and carts, farmers with the kids, you know, I suppose, getting away from the fighting. And in our ration packs, we were on 24-hour ration packs, the dehydrated stuff, and there was a chocolate. And of course, Nestle's plain chocolate. I didn't like plain. And I remember giving these little kids these bars of chocolate. I don't think I've seen chocolate for years.
Footage of a small boy in a beret accepting a chocolate.
The Allies fighting in France were supported by great innovations such as huge floating harbours, the Mulberry Harbours, and an underwater fuel line laid from southern England to France.
A giant cable reel rolling through shallow water.
But in the end, it was human courage, rather than new technology, that determined the outcome of the Battle of Normandy.
A line of weary-looking Allied soldiers, then gliding over a large cemetery with regimented rows of white gravestones. Jack Mortimer.
The main cemetery is in Bayeux. That's a great big cemetery. You're always moved when you see that cemetery. It's not a nice place, and yet it is a nice place. It's absolutely immaculate. It's very difficult not to be moved to
Reed wanted to read the gravestones and think that, well, I'm thankful it's not me.
An extraordinary endeavour, and not without cost. More than 4,500 men are buried here at Bayeux, the biggest Second World War Commonwealth cemetery in France. The youngest here, 17. The oldest, 58.
When you go to war, it's a strange feeling, because you personally feel there's nothing going to happen to you. You'll be all right. And that's the feeling you go in with. That's the feeling I went in with, but I was wrong in my case.
There was this extraordinary thing in that particular part of Normandy. The roads, the main roads, were very sunk. And the hedgerows had grown up above them. You couldn't actually see anything moving along these roads. But the Germans, of course, had been there much longer than we had. They knew it precisely.
It was very difficult country for the tanks. It's what they called bocage country.
In the bogage, the hedges used to be as high as 10 to 14 feet.
It was ideal country to defend, because a German with his anti-tank gun, it would knock a turret off a tank just quite easily, and then all he had to do was nip back into the hedge, and that was it.
It was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and a heavy mist came down. You could see absolutely nothing. And then it cleared, around about up our 7, we were able to move forward. And these were quite long fields with quite long and high hedges on either side of them. And there were German positions behind each one as we moved up the hill.
We were up against the elite of the German army and the armour.
And I'd only gone a few yards down this thing when a very gallant German popped up over the hedge and put a minded vapor into the turret. But there was a plaintive voice from underneath me. "Gadoot, sir, because my arse is on fire." And so this is my delightful gunner. And it was only then, as I put my right foot down, that I realised it kind of wasn't there. And there was no feeling it at all.
When you got up to the place where you started to engage the enemy, then you realised what it was all about.
Then I heard more tanks, and I thought, well, could be German. And so I just lay quietly. The tank stopped. And then I heard the tank commander, "Oh, look, there's poor Andrew. He was such a nice fellow." And so I rolled over and shouted back at him, "But less of the wars," I said, "send somebody over and get hold of me."
An injured soldier in a wheelchair.
We advanced and retreated 6 times before we finally drove the Germans out of the bogage. We lost more men and equipment in the bogage than we ever did on the landing.
The fighting went on through June and July. But for some British troops, their thoughts were never far from home.
"Sergeant Brown Comstock, you four have got a 72-hour pass. You can go where you like." So I said to Fritzy, my mate, in MLM, said, "I'm going to see Wynne." So he said,
"You're bloody stupid," he said. I said, "There's an aerodrome just down the road." We went down to there and I said, "Have you got anything going to Croydon tomorrow?" So they said, "We've got a Dakota going at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning." And I dressed myself up very nice and smart. I was going to see Wynne. Knocked on the door. And she come to the door, said, "You have come back." And I said, "But I can't stop. I've got to go back tomorrow." We had 72 hours, and I used the 72 hours coming to meet Wynne.
A black and white photo of the young couple. Bill Gladden.
Joe and Bob, they were dug in right on the edge of a pine forest, which was a bit dangerous because when Jerry started shelling us, they were hitting the trees and bursting down. And that's what happened with them two. Bob was the first one. We carried him over, he was in a bit of a mess. His face was all where bits of shrapnel had hit him and everything. And we took him over to the barn and took Joe across. Joe was dead. In fact, I was holding his head up on the stretchers. And Tommy got him over there. Bob had died then, so we had the two dead ones there.
There's never a day to go by without I think about the six good pals I lost in Normandy. All good lads, all them lads, same age as me. You know, sometimes I think, was it all worth it? But I look around at the world today. Was it? Or, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't like to say.
Bill's friends, Bob and Joe, were just two of the 73,000 Allied forces killed during the Battle of Normandy. Another 153,000 troops were wounded.
We'd just come back from a recce. And we come back into the orchard, and I was going to have a brew up, or a cup of tea, and then, and suddenly there was a bit of a clatter, and I was sitting on the ground. And I looked down, and I could see, because I had boots and breeches, being the dispatch rider, and my boot was blown open. It's just the Achilles holding my foot on.
Bill would spend much of the next 3 years in hospital. While he began his treatment in England, the Germans were retreating across Normandy. 23,000 of Hitler's troops would die. France was being liberated, but the cost for its civilians was huge. At least 20,000 people killed in Allied bombardments.
"We're very sorry, France, but we had to bomb your cities. And that's what they did. It was quite almost when it finished. And the unfortunate part was we killed French people. They had to die of it because of the Germans there. And then we moved on."
Buildings in ruin.
You don't think about it at the time, but afterwards, I thought how they used to welcome us, acknowledge us, and we killed so many of them by bombing and shelling, and they accepted us with open arms and welcomed us. And I've often wondered why.
An old newsreel. Normandy's battle continues.
Tilly?
Tilly said, yeah, that's where we were. Yeah.
"This is the newly famous Normandy village of Tilly-sur-Sel, called Tilly for short.
We bypassed by Bayeux, but we went on to a small market town of the name of Tilly. And Tilly was taken several times and retaken several times. And it was badly, badly knocked about. And that's our real first big engagement we had. I mean, those empty cartridges was red hot. As soon as they'd been fired, they were. You used to burn your hands moving the shells out, the shell cases.
You'd have to move quickly then.
Yes, yes, that's why they're throwing them out.
Yeah.
Yeah. We came across a German gun crew that had all been killed. One of the German gun was still sitting in his seat at the gun, dead. And that sticks out in my mind so much. Why do I remember that particular man sitting there and all the rest laying around him?
In early July, Ken Hay had been on a night patrol with his unit. They came under fire. Ken and his brother had been ambushed.
I said to him, "I'm scared." So he said, "What the, do you think I am?" Well, I'd never realised my brother could be scared. He was a big boy and he was a commando and he'd been to San Jose and he'd been to Norway. My brother couldn't be scared. I mean, this battle went on something like 2 to 3 hours because you get firing, and the worst bit is tracer. And when it's fired at night, it goes very slowly. It comes at you and wings pass. You're trying to get into the ground and you hear it whistle past. And that's when the faith starts to play a part, because the first prayers come then. And it's, "Lord, keep me safe," or, "If my number's up, let it be quick."
9 of Ken's unit were killed. 16, including Ken's brother, escaped. Ken was taken prisoner and the next day was confronted by a guard.
This is on the edge of a cornfield. It's about 8 o'clock, bright sunny morning, 8th of July, 44. Made me stand to attention, chin up, so on. And then he came and put his toes to my toes. And all I was conscious of was in his belt he had a miniature revolver. And I thought, this is what he does, you know? This is how we get killed. And he stood there. And then he put his hand on his own head, on his hat, flat hat, and he brought it across to my nose. Axen Yale, 18 years. And all he was doing was measuring my size, because I was 18 and I was very tall. That man doesn't know what he did to my stomach, but there we are.
The battle for Normandy was very, very hard, very tough. There's no doubt about it. There is a small cemetery now of the name of Jerusalem.
Rachel lets herself through a gate into the cemetery, where gravestones are set out in trenches filled with small shrubs.
This is the smallest of the Commonwealth War cemeteries in France. Fewer than 50 men are buried here. But it was to this intimate place that Donald returned many times to remember those he fought alongside in Normandy who were not given his long life.
Sometimes it doesn't seem real. Your life changes completely. You cope with what you've got and get on with it the best you can.
From above, shallow waves lapping a beach.
Age 20, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I'm so glad that I can be talking to you about it. I can tell my grandchildren about it, and maybe even a great-grandchildren.
You must always remember, somebody gave their life so you could be what you are today. And me, but I'm lucky. I've had, 70-odd years of freedom. I've enjoyed my freedom.
But I was really glad to be able to do something useful instead of being a housemaid or something, you know. I think a lot of us were very juvenile before the war, and this gave us an enormous amount of independence, I think. It had helped a whole generation of people my age. We were, from that moment on, we chose what we did. We didn't have to do what our mothers said.
We had first-hand experience of the war, and heaven forbid that anything like that ever happens again. I think it's history, and I think history is very important.
I often think the youth of today, I think they would have handled it the same. People say that they wouldn't have done, but I personally think I've done a lot of work with youth over my years, and I met some really good youth, and I'm sure they'd do exactly the same job as we did.
When you were in the service, you thought you were doing your little bit towards helping the war win. But unfortunately, it's not worked out right. We're still at wars now. And, when this war, our World War II finished, we were hoping that would be the end of wars. But it's not.
Although we won, we and the Allies won the war, it didn't come cheap. There were lots and lots of young lives went. It's such a waste of life.
I sit back now and thank God for how lucky I am. Couldn't go to war again, I don't think. I'd know all the dodges.
And did you feel like a hero?
No way. You were just another soldier.
Do you feel proud of what you did?
Now I'm 103, I often wonder why I've lived all this long, and so many of my mates and friends got killed.
Do you often think about them?
Yes.
Donald Halkins dabs his mouth with a tissue and sighs thoughtfully. Row upon row of names inscribed on a marble memorial that bears the date, 6th of June, 1944.
My little ditty says, so grateful to be alive, so grateful to have survived, so sorry so many had to die, so many heroes, and there they lie in Normandy. That's it.
In memory of Eddie Brown, Joe Cattini, Bill Gladden, Gilbert Gray, Gordon Prime, with thanks to the British Normandy Memorial, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission.